It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper? A woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver. I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or
prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18 plus. Happy holidays, y'all. Today we have a special holiday treat for you. Minnie is joining us. Hang on a second. Minnie's here, and we recorded this in the past, rewind, when Beth was in Canada with Minnie. So things may have changed since then. With that said, enjoy the show.
This podcast contains adult themes and language, and some of the things that we discuss may be disturbing to some listeners. In this podcast, we discuss sexual assault, torture, race, and murder. Listener discretion is advised.
Episode 143. Thank you for listening. Bienvenidos, bitches, and Buiti Binafi. Fruit Loops is a podcast about true crimes committed by people of color and the victims that we do not hear or know much about. Now, contrary to popular belief, not all serial killers are straight, cis, white, able-bodied dudes. No, they're not. It's just not true. And I'm here to tell you that there are many well-documented cases of serial killers of color, and Fruit Loops is a podcast all about them. We will take deep dives into the fascinating lives and crimes of serial killers and true crimes committed by people of color and the victims that the media and entertainment commonly leave out because the news is racist.
Allegedly.
And we are Wendy and Beth. She's Wendy, a Black Latinx woman. And I'm Beth, and I just happen to be white.
It's not her fault.
I laugh every time. We're not journalists, investigators, or psychologists, just a couple of gals interested in true crime. Also, the opinions expressed in this podcast are just that, our opinions. Please send any questions or comments to fruitloopspod@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail at 602-935-6294, and we may feature it on a future episode.
That's right. The phone number is 602-935-6294. Also, our website is fruitloopspod.com, and we use Fruit Loops Pod for all our social media. The footnotes for each episode can be found on our website. Plus, check it out for the different ways that you can support the show and become a Fruit Loops patron. Yeah. So, who are we talking about today, Beth?
Today we're talking about Hannah Mary Tabbs, a Black American woman who lived in Philadelphia during the late 1800s. So Victorian times. Ooh. Merry Christmas, y'all.
Hello.
Tabbs, along with an accomplice, participated in the murder and dismemberment of her alleged lover.
Whoa.
This subject was suggested to us by William, and it was researched and written by Minnie, who is also our special guest today. Welcome.
Whoa. Welcome, Minnie. One second, got something for you. Welcome, Minnie. So happy
My
you are
very
here.
My hip-hop air horn.
Absolutely. Would you expect anything less? No.
No.
So before we get into it, how you doing? Minnie, we'll start with you.
I'm doing great. My sister Beth is visiting me here in Canada. Ooh. And the weather's been actually quite nice. It's been unseasonably warm. So yeah, it's been nice. I kind of wanted her to see some snow, but we didn't really get much of that.
But there is snow on the ground, but it hasn't really snowed. Yeah.
Have you done any dashing through it?
We did go for a walk.
We did, yes. I wouldn't categorize that as dashing.
Snow.
Yeah, there you go. Walking through the snow. without an open sleigh.
No sleigh.
Yes. All right. Well, say less.
I'm good too. And like Minnie said, I'm visiting and it's been awesome. I've been relaxing a lot.
Nice.
Eating and going shopping. So
fantastic. Yeah. Well, I have missed you so, my friend.
Yeah, I miss you too.
I went over to your, because your desk is by the giant recycle right. bin. And basically, this was playing in my head. Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk to you again. And you weren't there.
Yeah.
But I'm so glad you're relaxing because you needed it, girl.
Yes, I sure did. So, yeah. So how are you doing?
Well, I'm good. I'm also out of the Phoenix area and traveled to my old stomping grounds of San Jose, California. And unfortunately, I'm here for one of my uncle's funerals. Oh. And so it's bittersweet, right?
Yeah.
I get to see everybody. I see all my old stomping grounds. It looks way different from when I was growing up here. And we all haven't been together in a very long time. And so there's a lot of us. It's already getting crazy. But nobody's gotten in a fight and the police haven't come. So things are good. So now we're going to get into some listener letters.
Well, hello, angels. Thank you.
Well, what's in that bag, Beth?
Well, guess what? There's nothing in the bag.
Oh, dang it.
These bitches, these angels brought this bag and there's nothing in it.
You brought an empty bag to a pod party?
They're very busy. It's Christmas. Yeah, they got better stuff to do.
That's
true. Oh my God. Jim dropping over here. That is a good point.
But it's fine. It's fine because this episode is going to be long and juicy.
Right. Well, before we get into it, we also don't have any new patrons or Patreons this week, so no shout out tunes. But I must say, we all are you guys Spotify listeners?
Yes.
Okay, so Spotify does your year-end wrap, and it tells you what genres you listen to, what are your top five podcasts. And so many of our listeners have reached out, screenshotted their, we are in their top five.
For
2021. And it's just been really, really wonderful. And we're so grateful. And sometimes we are running on empty, y'all.
Yeah.
But your love just really keeps us going. So I wanted to make a special thanks to on Instagram, Zashar, Pixelated Blonde, Steph Terrell, Great One Pinches, and Milk of Magnesia, yes, on Instagram for all your, like, just sending us the love and letting us know that you are rocking with us. We appreciate it.
And I love all your usernames, too.
So hip-hop everyone's to y'all, and we are going to take a quick break and get into the story when we come back.
Hi, I'm Sean McCabe.
And I'm Carrie McCabe.
We are, well, married, obviously, but we're also obsessed with the darker side of things.
True crime stories, alien abductions, poltergeists. If it leaves you scratching your head and keeping those lights on at night, we want to hear about it.
That's why we host the podcast, Ain't It Scary, with Sean and Carrie.
Every week, we bring our listeners a true story guaranteed to send chills down your spine. From history's most brutal serial killers to the mystery of spontaneous human combustion.
Yep, lots of these stories leave unanswered questions behind, and you'll get to poke through the rubble of the evidence with a hardened skeptic and
someone whose mind is more open to fun.
Yeah, that's what I was gonna say.
You can find Ain't It Scary with Sean and Carrie wherever you get your podcasts. And on social media at Ain't It Scary. Come play with us.
True terrors of horror, bizarre happenings, unexplainable events. On our podcast, Disturbed, terror takes center stage. Each episode is a journey into the darkest corners of human existence, delving into bone-chilling tales of kidnappings, serial killers, maniacs, and the very essence of your worst nightmares coming to life on this weekly true horror show. Disturbed is not for the faint of heart. It's an exploration of real, unadulterated horror sourced from everyday people. Each episode is a descent into the macabre, where we narrate stories that will leave you on the edge of your seat and crawling in your skin. We navigate the disturbing narratives that lurk in the shadows, offering a raw and unfiltered listen into the most terrifying aspects of the human experience. Enter at your own risk and let the unsettling tales unfold in the haunting realm of Disturbed. And remember, listeners, stay safe out there.
This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp Online Therapy.
People don't always realize that physical symptoms like headaches, teeth grinding, and even digestive issues can be indicators of stress. And let's not forget about doom scrolling, sleeping too little, sleeping too much, undereating, and overeating.
Okay, so the copy here says to talk about my experience with stress. Oh boy, do you have an hour? Where do I begin? Work, bills, life, family. I could go
podcast.
On for a very, podcast, a very long time. And I actually do. Though in therapy, which is so helpful for me, so I can manage, deal, and get through it.
Stress shows up in all kinds of ways. And in a world that's telling you to do more, sleep less, and grind all the time, here's your reminder to take care of yourself, do less, and maybe try some therapy.
BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist, so you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't wanna.
It's more affordable than in-person therapy. Give it a try and see if online therapy can help lower your stress.
This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp and Fruit Loop Serial Killers of Color. Listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/fruit.
That's BETTERHELP.com/fruit.
All right, guys, it's time for me to come clean. It's okay. It's time for me to tell the truth.
All right.
It's time for me to spill the beans.
Okay.
It's time to fess up. It's time to keep it a buck. Keep it 100.
Are you going to get to it?
Oh, yes. So sometimes after dark, I sneak away and play best fiends. Others may wonder about my mysterious disappearances. They say, who does she think she is? David Blaine? David Copperfield? I say none of the above. In fact, I'm having so much fun playing best fiends. Ever heard of it?
Why, yes, I have. I love best fiends. I love collecting the little monsters when you play so I can level up my fiends. Also, I love going in for the super long matches to free up the board and beat levels.
Ooh.
I am happy to report that I am on level 440.
That's amazing. Okay, friend, I see you flexing over there. Now, Best Fiends is a free-to-download mobile puzzle game with thousands of exciting new levels for new adventures and challenges every time you play. I am on level 304. Beth, tell them about the offline play.
Yes, of course. There is offline play, so you don't even need Wi-Fi or the internet.
Oh, good. So download your new favorite getaway, Best Fiends, for free today on the App Store or Google Play.
You'll even get $5 worth of in-game rewards when you reach level 5.
That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. We're back.
Woo.
Beth, yes, Beth or Minnie.
Whichever one.
Whichever one. Remind us who our subject is today.
You want to take it, Minnie?
Oh, sure. So our subject is Hannah Mary Tabbs. She was a Black woman who lived in post-Reconstruction era Philadelphia when in 1887, a headless, limbless torso was found floating in a pond.
My eyes are so large. They're going to pop out of my head.
As a little aside here. So I was telling, so I play World of Warcraft. You guys know this.
Mm-hmm.
And I was telling one of my guild members that I was doing some research for true crime. I wasn't, super specific. And so she sent me the usual, oh, look at these three little white girls who were missing in Texas. So I sent her a link to what I was researching. She's like, what? A torso? What? Dismembered? What? I'm like, yeah, it's more like that.
Wow. Oh my gosh. She wasn't
amusing.
Ready.
She was not ready. But then she was intrigued after that. But
oh, good.
Yes.
Good.
Yes. Absolutely.
So they found a headless, limbless torso floating in a pond. And then an investigation soon led to Tabbs and an alleged accomplice.
Ooh. Oh, right. Well, normally at this point in our show, we'd get into some stats. But We're low on stats. And we'll just pepper important facts throughout the story. There's one victim here. So
yeah.
Here we go. The setting. Take us there, Minnie.
All right. So as I said, this is in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania in 1887. Now, this land, of course, is not traditional home to the Europeans who are living
right
there.
No.
At this point, right?
I don't say.
This first time. Surprise, surprise. So, as usual, we like to acknowledge the original peoples of the lands where we talk about. So the land where Philadelphia now sits is part of the traditional home of the Lenape people. Mm-hmm. These people were also known as the Lenni Lenape and the Delaware people. And until the Europeans interfered with them, they lived in what is now known as Delaware, New Jersey, and New York, including Long Island, as well as in Pennsylvania.
So they had a very large
interfered. Really, Europeans were only successful because they carried so many germs.
Yeah.
That's crazy. Mm-hmm.
So their social system was matrilineal, meaning their ancestry and property was determined by the female line, and matrilocal, meaning married couples stayed close to the wife's family. I like that. So these people were already living in the area now known as Pennsylvania when the Europeans arrived. When Europeans began to settle, they pushed these people farther and farther west. And today, most Lenape live in Oklahoma.
Wow, quite a distance from where they came from. Yep. Now, the first European settlements in the area were founded by the Dutch, who considered the entire Delaware River Valley to be part of their new Netherland colony. Swedish colonies began to develop in the region as well, and both cultures grew their population, settling over more land, though continuing to live along with the Lenape. The Dutch and Swedish kept mostly to their forts, though.
Enslaved Africans arrived in the area that became Philadelphia as early as 1639, brought by European settlers. In 1664, an English fleet captured the new Netherland colony, though nothing really changed for the area until about 1682.
It was at this time that Philadelphia was given its name by William Penn, who had been granted a charter for the area by the then King of England, Charles II, in order to settle a debt that the king owed to Penn's father. Pennsylvania itself had been named by the king after William Penn's father, which apparently embarrassed William.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So William Penn was a Quaker, a faith known for its adherence to humility, equality, and to brotherhood. And he named the colony Philadelphia, which means brotherly love in Greek. He named it after a similarly named city from the Book of Revelation. Ooh, from the Book of Revelation. The Book of Revelation, which had purportedly served as a site of Christian meetings during a time of persecution. I can talk, I promise. Sorry.
I've heard you talk lots of times.
Okay.
So William Penn wanted Philadelphia to be a place where anyone could worship freely. This was during a time when the idea that a person might have a direct relationship with a Christian God rather than going through a priest was relatively new and was aggressively suppressed in some parts of Europe.
Yes, it was. The province of Pennsylvania was already known by this time as a place where any religion was tolerated as long as it was Judeo-Christian, which drew a great variety of colonists from Europe, including the Huguenots, Puritans, Calvinists, Mennonites, Catholics, Anglicans, and Jews. Penn may have had good intentions, but in the end, this did not equate to freedom for everyone.
In 1682, William Penn purportedly signed the Treaty of Shackamaxon with the Lenape, in which he agreed that with the Lenape's chief, Tamenend, that their peoples would coexist in perpetual peace and friendship. But I'm sure there's a gotcha in there somewhere.
Yeah.
Chief Tamenend was also known for being a proponent of brotherly love, though there is still debate over whether or not such a treaty was ever signed.
It probably was, and then white people were like, no, we're not doing this.
Yeah. Penn had plans to recreate an ordered English rural community with large lots and garden plots laid out in grid systems. So it was kind of a fanciful dream of his. But of course, in reality, this just didn't work for the area. The colonists started to just sort of organically crowd near the port for trading purposes. And then they ended up subdividing and selling their plots to new settlers. As the population swelled, it became a city established in 1701 and then continued to grow into an important center for trade with its well-placed port.
By the 1750s, Philadelphia had surpassed Boston to become the largest city and busiest port in British America and second in the British Empire after London. Wow. The 1750s and 60s, when the slave trade increased due to a shortage of European workers, 100 to 500 Africans were brought to Philadelphia each year.
Yeah, I think people forget that there was slavery in the North.
Right.
But just a reminder, that's a lie. In 1765, there were about 1,500 Black Philadelphians. Of these, 100 were free. By the time the American Revolution broke out in 1775, enslaved people were 1/12 of the roughly 16,000 people who lived in Philadelphia.
Philadelphia is the site where the U.S. Declaration of Independence was signed. Again, yeah, right? And it is worth noting in this moment that this did not equate to freedom for all. Mm-hmm. Yeah. By this time, there were quite a number of free Black people living in the area, some workers, some businessmen, some privateers, some freed slaves, but still a large number of enslaved Black people existed in the area.
The free Black community in Philadelphia had grown to over 1,000 by the end of the revolution in 1783, while enslaved residents numbered 400 out of a total population of about 28,000. The Pennsylvania Abolition Society was founded by white Quakers in 1775, and eventually became a biracial organization. That's pretty cool.
That is cool. That's how you get things done. Multiracial coalitions.
That's right.
In 1780, a policy of gradual emancipation was instituted in Pennsylvania. Most of the Black population in Philadelphia were free by 1811, although some remained enslaved until the 1840s. The free community was joined by runaways from the South and refugees from the Haitian Revolution, and the Free African Society was founded here in 1787, and the Bethel African Methodist Church was founded here in 1794.
Nice.
It was not all sunshine, lollipops, and rainbows for the Black people in Philadelphia, though.
No, say it ain't so.
No. Anyway, you'll hear it in a second. So during the 1793 Philadelphia yellow fever epidemic, Black residents were mistakenly believed to be immune to the disease, so they worked as carriers of the dead and tended to the sick and dying inside their homes. It was like, oops, we made a mistake. I feel like it's more like, you guys are immune. Probably fine, so you go do that, you know.
Black people are immune, so let's make them carry the dead.
Parallels between this and coronavirus, because who were most of the essential workers?
It's crazy. It's still happening.
Yeah.
So that was going on. And then kidnapping of free Black residents to be sold back into slavery was a risk that continued into the 19th century, especially for children. Fun times.
There was also racial discord that continued in the area into the 1800s, even though Philadelphia was a major player in the abolitionist movement. While some Black folks in Philadelphia worked in professional jobs that served the Black community, like teachers, doctors, ministers, barbers, caterers, and entrepreneurs, most Black Philadelphians at that time worked at physically demanding and low-paying jobs. They competed with working-class whites, especially new Irish immigrants, for jobs, which led to racial conflict. They're taking our gerbs.
they're taking our right. And Dr. Carrie Gross, I think her name is. I'm sure we'll be talking about her a lot throughout this episode. But she said most of the jobs for Black women in particular, since we're talking about Hannah Tabbs, were domestic workers. So 90% of them were domestic workers. So despite the risks and racism that they encountered, Black Americans continued to come to Philadelphia since it was the closest major city to the southern states where slavery was still legal. In the years leading up to the Civil War, Philadelphia had the largest Black population outside of the slave states.
Wow.
During the Civil War, 11 Black regiments from Philadelphia fought for the North. After the passage of the 1862 Second Militia Act allowed Black Americans to be employed as soldiers. After the Civil War, Black Americans in Philadelphia organized to end segregation of the city's schools and streetcars and to regain the right to vote.
Ooh.
In 1867, streetcar segregation was ended throughout the state, and legal segregation of schools ended in 1881, although de facto segregation continued into the 20th century. So it was not legal, but they still did it.
Ew.
The 15th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution gave Black Americans in Pennsylvania the right to vote in 1870.
But wait, not everyone in Philadelphia was on board with the idea of civil rights for Black people.
What?
Octavius, no, you're kidding. Octavius V. Cato, a civil rights activist, was shot and killed while trying to cast his ballot
in
1871.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
The Black population in Philadelphia rose to nearly 32,000 in 1880 out of a total population of about 85,000.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a large percentage.
Yeah.
In 1884, there were approximately 300 Black-owned businesses, including the Philadelphia Tribune, which was started in 1884.
Impressive.
So this was the social climate in which our story occurs.
Okay.
Okay, we're here now. We're getting into the early life of Hannah Mary Tabbs. What do you got for us, Beth?
Hannah Mary Tabbs was born as Hannah Ann Smith sometime around 1850 in Maryland. The date of her birth was not recorded, and it's very possible that she was born into enslavement, as Maryland did have a mix of enslaved and free Black people during this time.
And that just still boggles my mind. I mean, we're obviously not new to the concept here, but every once in a while, it just kind of hits me harder than usual to think that a living, breathing human person can be considered the property of another human being,
right?
Especially when that living, breathing human being is a baby.
Yeah. Doesn't
it's
make any
crazy.
Damn sense.
No, it doesn't. And you know, just like take a moment to say that out loud to yourself.
Yeah.
To hear how crazy it sounds. And,
right.
And think about what it means for a human baby, or any human for that matter, to be the property of another human being, like cattle, like farm implements,
right?
A belonging, like a fucking hat.
Yeah. That, my face just, is contorting. Yeah. It's
right.
It doesn't make any
like
sense.
And to me, like I try to wrap my head around sometimes how a person, I'm very empathetic, and I like to understand people by thinking about what it's like to be them.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
This is something I can't do. I can't imagine what it's like.
How do you justify that?
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know. But so for it to be possible for one human to think of another human that way, I'm like, I own that human being over there.
Yeah.
Like, what the fuck?
Doesn't make any sense.
No.
But I will say, you know, the slavery has not really ended. In the West, it's just transformed.
Yeah.
So maybe people, individual human beings aren't owning people, but the state is, the government is, institutions are. So it's still something that's really difficult to wrap your mind around. It doesn't make any sense.
And when I try to imagine what it's like to be those people as well, I can't. Like, how do you do that?
Anybody who finds an answer, let me know, because I'm listening. I just don't get it.
Yeah. So anyway, back to the story. That's the world she was born into. And when you think about it generationally, it wasn't even all that long ago.
No.
Right.
Just a few grandparents ago.
Right, yeah, right.
You know?
Absolutely. I'm glad you said that. Minnie, I love you.
So now,
one of the frustrating things about this time is that Black people, and even more so Black women, unless they were unusual in some way, meaning mostly that they had some significant involvement in the life of a white person, records just weren't created or kept on them. So it's very difficult to find anything about the lives of ordinary Black women of the time.
Until Hannah committed a crime against a mixed race man with the assistance of another mixed race man, there just wasn't much attention on her. So there's a lack of information, and we can really only guess as to what her early life might have been like.
In an article for the BBC, Dr. Callie Nicole Gross, author of Hannah Mary Tabbs and the Disembodied Torso, wrote, quote, Despite the numerous assaults she committed in the Black community, she had no criminal record. It wasn't until authorities believed that her victim was a white man that she found herself in the crosshairs of the justice system, unquote.
What we do know is that Hannah was born sometime around 1850 in Anne Arundel County, Maryland, or Merland, where about half of the Black people living there at the time were free and half were enslaved. She was about 15 during the time of the American Civil War, and by the end of it was a young woman with a mixed race baby to care for.
The official story is that the baby was an orphan niece that Hannah took care of as her own after her sister and brother-in-law died of yellow fever. But it is believed that the baby was probably her own daughter. In any case, her name was Annie Richardson.
When she was young, Hannah likely worked either as a slave or as a free servant. She then worked her way up to Baltimore, Maryland, which is a remarkable thing for a Black woman to do at the time, given the climate of racism, sexism, and routine violence experienced by Black women.
And in 1874, she met and married John Tabbs, an older man who was well-employed, financially stable, and who cared well for her and Annie. John later described Hannah as, quote, crazy and ignorant and foolish, unquote. Love you too. And he actually sent her to school in Baltimore to unlearn some of her coarse ways.
Whoa.
Yeah. Just coarse.
I think old Whitey's probably taking notes.
Maybe old Whitey needs to go to school. Yeah.
So about 10 years after the Civil War ended, the family relocated to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. There, Hannah Mary was known in the neighborhood as having a violent temper, and local residents were afraid of her. In 1886, Annie Richardson, who by this time was a young woman, went missing. Many folks in the neighborhood assumed that Hannah Mary had killed her.
Uh-oh. Wow. So now we're going to, that is quite the early life. Now yeah. We're going to get into the timeline. Hit it, Beth.
In 1887, Hannah Mary Tabbs was living with her husband, John, in their house in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. By many accounts, Tabbs was having an affair with 24-year-old Wakefield Gaines, who went by the nickname of Wake. That's a cool name.
I know. It sounds like a cool name, which this doesn't have any merit, or I don't know what I'm basing this off of, but maybe he was a handsome, wonderful man. I don't know.
Yeah.
With a nickname like Wake.
Yeah, I'm sure he was handsome.
Like he was he was
24. He was younger than her.
Yeah.
He was probably handsome. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
Okay, Wake, we see you. So
I'm getting all excited. I know.
Like, oh, man. The affair was inappropriate. The affair was
sorry, everybody.
My bad. The affair was intense, and Tabbs had become extremely jealous and volatile. Wake apparently did not feel the same towards Tabbs as Tabbs felt towards him, and it was reported that he had become engaged to another woman, which caused Tabbs to come at him with a razor 2 weeks
like a
before.
Spider monkey.
2 weeks before the murder. Don't make me mad. I will cut you. Oh, man.
Oh. According to Tabbs, the events leading up to the murder started on Wednesday, February 16th, 1887. Her story is that her friend, Wake Gaines, had come to her house that morning on a social call. Escándalo.
Oh, Maria.
Maria. Wake Gaines was reading the paper, allegedly.
Is that what we're calling
and
it?
And Tabbs was allegedly eating breakfast when another friend, 18-year-old George Wilson, came to the door. Tab said that Wilson had told her that he was going to pick up Annie from Jenkintown, which is north of Philadelphia, in order to take her riding.
So I just was going to give a tad of background on Wilson. I didn't see it in the script, so I don't want to, if it's already in there, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
But so he was a young Black man who lived in this place called the House of Refuge for Colored Youth. Mm. And it was basically like a juvenile detention center for Black kids, for families who were poor and destitute after the Civil War and couldn't find jobs and couldn't support their families and didn't have any other place to put their kids to prevent them from being homeless and starving to death. So Wilson, his dad was in prison and his mother had just died. And like many Black children who were in similar destitute situations, he ended up at that house of refuge for colored youth. And side note, Wilson's mom was also institutionalized there as a youth. So there's this weird cycle. Tabs said that Wake had asked if Wilson was dating Annie, and that Tabs replied that she didn't really care as long as she got to see her girl. And if you recall, at this point, Annie, her niece slash daughter, we don't know, had been missing for a while.
Tabs claimed that Wakefield then got up and struck Wilson, and they began to fight. Wilson grabbed a chair and struck Wakefield in the head with it, then continued beating him with it after Wakefield fell. Tabs said he never got up again.
According to Tabs, she told Wilson that what he had done was awful, but that Wilson responded by saying that Wake had hit him first. And I'm going to try that next time I commit murder. But they hit me first. I had to beat them to death.
Well,
Wait, did I say next time? I mean the first time.
Oh, Biff. Well, in this day and age, who knows what the self-defense argument
is. Yeah, for sure.
So according to Tabs, together they cleaned up the blood and the carpet and pulled Wake's body down to the cellar, then removed Wake's clothes and tied them up in a bundle. She then went up to make sure no one was coming while Wilson cut up the body.
Ooh.
Yikes.
When she came back down, she found that Wilson had wrapped the head in paper, pushed the limbs under the steps, and set aside the torso. He then told her he planned to scatter the pieces and that she would be responsible for disposing of the torso after they found something to wrap it in.
Obviously.
Right. I'm thinking they're going to get away with it. I mean, this is very clever.
Yep.
Solid plan. Yeah. She claimed that Wilson carried the body upstairs and she located an old calico shirt and a shawl to wrap it in, as well as a shawl strap to carry the bundle. And if you're not familiar with what a shawl strap is, and I wasn't. It's a device used to carry a rolled up blanket, mat, or shawl. It has a loop on each end, and the two loops connect together by a middle strap, which is then used as a handle to carry the item. So it's like a yoga mat strap, which we use
Danny. Okay, you just painted the picture. Thank you for that. Now, Tabs claimed that once they had everything packaged up, they waited until dark, then each left the house with the pieces they were going to dispose of. She said Wilson had asked her when her husband would be home, and he told her that he would meet her at the depot later.
According to Tabs, she went to the railway station and bought a return ticket to Cornwalls and back, but got off in Eddington instead. There, she stopped at a house to ask for directions to Bridgeport, then walked along the road until she found a bridge, then tossed the torso over after removing the shawl strap and a piece of the calico covering.
Hey, quick question. Do we think she got asked for directions to sort of create like an illusion of an alibi, or does she really need directions to this bridge?
I really don't know, because it seems like a dumb thing to do. Put herself in that area, because it sounds to me like she wanted, the alibi was she was in Cornwalls, right? Mm-hmm. But she got off at Eddington, so she could say that, oh no, I went to Cornwalls, but then she asked for directions.
I thought that was weird as well. I don't know why she made that choice to do that. Yeah.
So she said she was almost spotted by some men in a buggy, but she hid in the bushes until they passed. She then continued walking to Cornwalls and took the train from there back to Philadelphia. According to Tabs, she still had the bundle of clothing with her when Wilson met her at the station.
Fuck! What? You weren't supposed to do that, right? Wasn't she supposed to dump it? So she said she was afraid that Wake's name was on the clothes. So she had decided not to dispose of them along with the body. Instead, she gave the bundle of clothing to Wilson when he met her at the station and told her he would dispose of them. Or he told her that.
She said that she only saw him one other time, and that's Wilson, that she only saw him one other time after that when he came to her house a few days later to warn her that the discovery of the torso was in the papers, and that if she told anyone what she knew about it, it would be just as bad for her as it was for him.
Ooh.
Hmm.
AM, the comedy horror podcast that holds weekly gatherings around the campfire. Let me tell you what you're going to get. You're going to hear stories about demonic possessions, prison stabbings, skinwalkers, glitches in the Matrix, cult leaders, missing 411, night marchers, Operation Paperclip, Mesopotamian devil worship, and so many monsters it'll give Kanye West a runaway for his money. Pop and meme culture also aren't off topic. A camp where laughs and scares are constantly competing for first place. We're just a group of friends trying to bust each other's balls, find the best stories, and expand the circle in the process. 3 a.m., the comedy horror podcast, not for the faint or fragile of heart. Let's go.
The truth about the Haditha massacre has been covered up, but not anymore.
I know you know what happened.
They went into houses and killed women and children.
What are you thinking?
What a mess.
U.S. Marines murdered innocent civilians in cold blood.
And at the center of it all
is 25-year-old Sergeant Frank Wooderich.
And me. Murder in House 2. A new podcast from Crowd Network.
Get ready for your starring role in a thrilling adventure full of hidden clues, immersive scenes, danger, and romance.
That's right. It's June's Journey, and you play June Parker, an amateur detective investigating a series of mysteries.
Ooh, you'll put your powers of observation to the test, sharpen your sleuthing skills, find objects, and claim rewards.
The visuals are fire. It's like a party for your eyeballs. As you play this thrilling adventure full of hidden clues, immersive scenes with danger and romance in full force.
Whether you're craving a good mystery or just need to get away for a while, June's Journey is the perfect game for you.
It really is a sweet escape. I like to play when I need a mental pick-me-up.
There is a detective in all of us. Find your inner detective. Download June's Journey free today on the Apple App Store or Google Play. So now we're going to get into the investigation and the arrest. What's up, Beth?
On February 17th, 1887, a man named Silas Hibbs was walking to work when he passed over a bridge. The bridge crossed what was then known as Totham's Creek near the Eddington Railway Station in Pennsylvania.
I just think Silas is such an 1887
name. Oh, yeah.
Isn't it? So Silas Hibbs noticed a bit of a bloody calico cloth on the bridge and then spotted a package floating in the water near the edge of William B. Mann's ice pond nearby. The package was wrapped in string and labeled "Handle with care." Okay. And he opened it and found inside a dismembered torso. Surprise, motherfucker! Just kidding.
Worst jack-in-the-box ever.
Agreed.
So the Eddington area at the time did not have much of a police force and was primarily white. It was mainly policed by its own citizens, along with an area sheriff and a few local constables. Silas Hibbs reported the finding of the torso to some local citizens, who then reported it to authorities in the town of Bristol to the northeast.
Initially, they thought maybe the torso was medical waste, which made sense to them, as Philadelphia to the southwest was a hub of medical research and training at the time. So, you know, they're just tossing torsos in the water.
Could be bodies floating around everywhere. Who knows?
By the way, the U.S.'s first medical college for women, founded in 1850, was located at the University of Philadelphia. Pretty cool.
Wow, look at that. That is cool. So the body was dumped in Eddington, not Cornwall.
Correct.
Right?
Yes, in Eddington. Right.
Okay, got it.
Yeah, so her ticket was to Cornwall, and she dumped it in Eddington.
Got you. Okay. After examining the torso further, though, the coroners decided that it couldn't be medical waste because the cuts on the torso were too amateurish to have
been done by students.
Yeah, right? You got to start somewhere. Been done by a medical professional or one in training at the university. The marks on the torso also appeared to have been made by a rough blade, not a medical instrument.
Okay.
According to some accounts, there were also signs that the person had still been alive while the body had been dismembered. Yeah, which would not be the case for medical waste. One yes. So I'm not really sure what kind of signs would indicate that, but I'm guessing possibly the pattern of blood flow or coagulation would be different in a body that was cut. Yeah, with a still beating heart versus one in which the heart had already.
Right.
So. But I'm not a medical professional, so don't fact check me. I stole your line.
I love it. I have all the lines.
Investigators at the scene found the shawl strap as well as the bloody piece of calico that Silas had seen as he walked on the bridge. The strap that investigators found was made of natural materials and had nickel buckles on it.
Based on the condition of the strap, its nickel buckles, and the condition of the torso, which was still oozing blood and had soft skin when Silas found it. Super gross. speak for yourself. I'm very intrigued. By the way, we didn't get into one of the sources I cited got into details about the actual dismemberment and the tools used. Mm-hmm. But I guess that we are not going to be discussing that. But if you want to know,
well, you can,
you
if you
can
want
go
to.
Into yeah, our sources free. And find out. So they decided that the torso could not have been in the water for long. They estimated that it must have been dismembered the evening before on February 16th, 1887.
They also found that the torso showed signs of having been thrown because of an indentation that they found in the soil near the spot where the torso was
Yikes.
Found. So it kind of sounds like it might have like hit and then rolled or something. I don't know, because it was in the water when they found it.
I'm laughing, but I'm thinking of, you know, Parks and Rec when What's-Her-Face falls down the embankment. I'm just thinking of like it dropping like that.
And it fell in the hole in the park. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Oh, sorry. I'm a sick fuck, everybody.
And we love you for it.
I am what I am. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, it looked like it had been thrown because of the indentation, and also the calico cloth that they found at the scene appeared to have been wrapped around the package before it was thrown, based on the markings of blood on the material.
This was further indication that the torso was very unlikely to have been medical waste that had simply floated down the river from the hospital in Philadelphia.
Gotta say, I'm impressed with the caliber of forensic investigation that they have.
Back in 1887?
Even back then. It's really impressive. Mm-hmm. So as investigators spoke with some of the locals, they were given more information. A man named John Murray reported that he had seen the shawl strap and kicked it out of the way when he had crossed the bridge the night before. He estimated that it was about 1 a.m. when he had done that. This information aided the investigators in determining when the torso had been left there and what time the death might have occurred.
Local constables and residents dragged the pond, but didn't find any other body parts there. They did have plans to drain the pond, but it began to rain heavily enough that it would not have been possible to do so. And I, for some reason, just keep having the nightmare before Christmas running through
Go
my head.
On.
Perhaps it's the head that I found in the lake. And the song when Jack Skellington is talking about things that would go well as Christmas presents, and the other townspeople are singing about the stocking. Uh-huh. Does it still have a foot? Let me see. Let me look. Is it rotted and covered with gook?
Oh, happy holidays.
I think Minnie is also a sick fuck.
I am a little bit.
Oh, kindred spirit alert.
Yep.
Discussion of the case with the press was not handled well by the current district attorney, Hugh B. Eastburn, and a bit of a public panic followed. More and more journalists began to arrive in the area, and white locals took it upon themselves, as they always do, to become informal investigators, even now.
Wow. So
podcasts,
internet sleuths.
Web sleuths. Even to the point of arranging meetings to discuss the case and possible other victims and perpetrators.
I bet they would have had a message for it.
Yeah, I know. I feel like we have to pay homage to our like ancestral murder mystery like clubs and groups. Yes.
Yeah. Yep.
So their focus went toward Black people, and they began to point out missing or suspicious to them Black people that they had noticed. They also began to point fingers at others within their own community who they already didn't like. Seems a bit like a Salem witch hunt type of thing. And this muddied the investigation a little bit. So take a seat, Karens. You're not invited to this murder mystery party. I just wanted to say, I have a little culture corner here with Wendy Beth and Minnie. And according to Dr. Kelly Nicole Gross, the ambiguity of the race of this torso during this time it was important,
right?
Because slavery had been abolished. Philadelphia was a free state before the Civil War, but still very racist and discriminatory towards Black Americans. And there was also an influx of European immigrants at this time, which caused a shift in the definition of what it meant to be white. And on top of all that, this was a dead, maybe white guy. And a dead white guy is way more significant and newsworthy than a dead Black guy. So,
yeah. If it had been
definitively
a dark torso,
Black.
Yeah, they it probably would not have gotten this level of attention.
Absolutely.
Yeah, fun times.
Oh, yes.
So they have this torso,
right?
But meanwhile, the coroner still didn't have the head of the victim to help identify who this person was. They were also keen to determine the person's race in order to help identify them. Dr. Groom, who was assigned to the case, studied the skin cells and determined that it must be a man of mixed race based on the scientific knowledge of skin cells at the time. But the local coroner, DA, and police chief were hesitant to believe this, as it touched on white societal fears of mixing races and of light-skinned Black people passing as white in their community.
Santa Maria.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, this was already a sort of volatile area socially,
right,
as far as race is concerned.
Right. So I was just going to throw in another culture corner about passing and how terrifying it is to white people, and also to cishet people, cishetero people. So,
I never occurred to me that the term passing could also be used
for LGBTQ people. Absolutely.
Oh my God.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. My mind is blown.
Help her over there, Beth. Yeah.
First mind blowing.
I'll help you pick up your head there.
Yes.
Put it back on my torso.
Oh my God. Just like in the story. So racial passing is when a person classified as a member of one racial group is accepted or perceived, or they pass as a member of another. And it also occurs among pockets of all marginalized groups, basically. And there is a fear among the non-oppressed group, as I said, like white people or straight cishet people, that they will be infiltrated and that somebody will be among us that we don't know what they are, but they're pretending to be like us, right? And that also goes for LGBTQ trans folks, you know, who are just, everybody's just trying to be themselves and live.
Leave them alone. Jesus,
but sometimes
Christ.
You have to pretend in order to do, to get ahead.
Yeah.
And so those of us in marginalized communities who can pass are not, it's not doing so to try to trick anybody. It is just to survive. And there
survive.
Are,
yeah,
right. And I know you guys are going to get into this, but when I first found out about your ancestry story, I thought a lot about maybe they don't know the history because stories in families with people who passed for survival didn't discuss it. And so the generations that came after them were unaware.
They're not,
but it really
tell
right,
people.
It was, exactly, because it was dangerous to do so. Not because they wanted to keep it a secret or anything.
Right.
So just something to think about.
Yeah.
True. True, true.
So back to the story. The local coroner, the DA, and the police chief insisted on further examination and began to use questionable tactics to do so, including bringing in two Black women to compare their skin with that of the torso.
Oh my God.
Right?
Oh my God. Science.
Jeez.
Yep. And these are not the scientists.
No,
it's worth pointing out. So they're like refusing to listen to the scientists.
And they're like,
no, we're going to do this instead.
We're going to bring a Black lady in and
this'll do.
This'll work. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the coroner grabbed the arm of one of the Black women and tried to hold her arm next to the torso.
Oh my God.
But this repulsed her, you think? To the point that she backed away and refused to go near the torso again.
Oh my Atlanta. Oh my gosh. Yeah. So they then followed by asking the opinion of the other Black woman as to whether or not this could be a torso of a Black man. She declined to give a definite response, stating that, quote, "White folks look so much like colored folks nowadays, hard to tell the difference," unquote. I like that lady.
What are you going to say?
I know. It's like either you're damned if you do, damned if you don't. That was the perfect response.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. So the coroner, the DA, and the police chief were still reluctant to trust Dr. Groom's finding that this was a mixed-race man. They were that uncomfortable with the concept of it. There were some interesting, and by interesting, I mean racist, ideas in the public of where the color of black skin came from. And this is in the general public, of course, such as possibly from the blood. Really? Yeah, right? Or the liver. What? Really? Or some other organ in the body. Really? Like they've got a special organ that makes black skin.
Wow.
I don't know. Anyway. Yeah.
Wow.
So they wanted to examine the torso more thoroughly before deciding the race.
Yeah. The scientists already looked at the cells and said.
Yep.
There were also plenty of racial purists at the time who actually believed that white people and black people were two different species.
Come again?
Yeah.
What the fuck?
Oh my God.
And they, of course, would then be incapable of producing offspring that could procreate.
Oh my God. Wow.
Like a mule, right?
Right, yeah. Right.
And yeah. that's where the term mulatto comes from.
Right. I didn't know that. Or I forgot it. Something. Yeah, that's awful. Uh-huh.
Wow.
Yeah, it is. It's terrible. Yeah.
So an unquestionably mixed race person of very light skin that had to be the product of a bond between a mixed race person and a white person would have caused an uproar among such people. Like, wait, what? Yep. They're all humans?
Wait a minute.
Oh, no, my life is ending.
That's it. Tell my mom I love her. Oh my God. So the idea that there could be other mixed race people in their community, quote unquote, passing as white, would also have been a very unsettling thought for them. Uh-oh, why's you're scared, everybody? Sometimes I'll take my kids places and I'm like, oh, we have to be on our best. We don't want to scare the white people. Okay. So this made the case even more interesting to the press, and it got yet more attention.
Yeah.
So I'm pretty sure this is Minnie. I'm pretty sure I figured out where in our Beth and Minnie's family tree our black DNA is. So yeah, I started poking around because I'm on 23andMe, and my our uncle is on there, and he's got even stronger black DNA.
Wow.
And so it's definitely on that side of the family. So I started poking around in the family tree. And then I started
shaking some branches, y'all.
Yeah, I started shaking some branches. But I couldn't get anywhere by talking to people. They would all just sort of shut down once you started poking a little bit. So I tried ancestry.com and I started going up the family line. And on one side, you can go up and keep going up. And on the other side, it just ends. It simply ends.
Interesting.
So our maternal grandmother's grandfather, I'm pretty sure, was mixed race, and he was either passing as white or he might not have even known that he was mixed race because he was actually a private in the Confederate Army.
Whoa, oh my God. Dangerous. So, right,
yeah. So he might not even have known, or he was overcompensating something. You know, it's like, I'll prove how white I am. But
wow.
I don't know. I really don't know. But so his mother was never married. And his father is listed as not recorded.
Whoa.
So there's no information.
Interesting.
So I can only assume, I'm assuming that his father was mixed race or black. So, of course, his mother couldn't have married his father because it was illegal at the time.
Right. Wow.
Fucking illegal. Like
until the 1960s,
that's
by the way.
Thing that blows my mind.
Which is nuts.
Yep. It's crazy.
Wow, though.
So 1967, that late,
crazy.
It was still, that's the year when it became legal for, like, what?
Wow.
Anyway, that's a whole
whole other episode.
Can of worms.
So
he was the only child she ever had, and she lived into a ripe old age. She was in her 80s. So she never had another child. She never got married. And so I shudder to think what might have happened to his father.
Yeah.
And his mother was born in 1811.
Wow.
So I imagine his father was born at a similar time, meaning that his father's father would have been born sometime in the 1700s, which is when 23andMe says our Black ancestor would have been
wow.
born.
Wow. So, oh my God. Yeah, did you guys cry and hug after yeah. you found this information?
I was pretty excited. Well, we were, I was here on my own when I found, that I was just kind of doing it on my own and just, I don't know. I struggle. Like I want to know the stories
yeah.
and, but I can't know the stories. And so you just kind of make up stuff in your head. And I feel like that's gotta be similar for some others who are ignored in the
yeah.
past, you know, like we were talking about at the beginning of the episode, you know, unless the Black people, their lives were intersected with a white person in some way, they weren't even recorded.
Yeah.
Like we don't even know
yeah.
Hannah Mary Tabb's date of
yeah.
birth.
Yeah.
You know?
It's wild.
So yeah. And so I think that's probably part of why a lot of people of color aren't as interested in doing
genealogy,
these DNA
yeah.
or doing their ancestry, genealogy, whatever, because you can only go so far and then there's no record.
Yeah.
And so you can't kind of go back in time and track back your stories,
yes.
you know. We want stories.
We absolutely
you know?
Do. I will say mm-hmm. that now that you know, you do have some African ancestry. There is African ancestry
yeah.
DNA tests. And
oh.
another, one thing that, this is a total side note, but one thing that Black people are not comfortable with is people keeping our DNA evidence because turns out they later use it. You know who Henry
yeah.
Lacks is. They use it later for either nefarious purposes or purposes to make money
yeah,
without
true.
Our knowledge or credit.
Yeah.
So this yep. African ancestry tells you like what tribe, what part of Africa you're from. And so it's super expensive though. And they dispose of your DNA information afterwards.
Oh,
yeah.
Afterwards.
It's just really, really expensive.
Okay.
But yeah. Listen, Patreons and patrons. Also, you heard it here, folks. I think that 23andMe and Ancestry should be free for anybody with African ancestry. There, I said it. I said it.
Up. Okay. Yep.
But thank you for sharing that. I love that story.
Yeah. Very
yeah.
cool. So you're up, Minnie.
Oh, I'm up. All right. My turn. But I just had a turn.
You get another one. Look at you.
That's what she said. Anyway.
Minnie is the queen of the, that's what she said.
Is she?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
I'm
okay.
terrible. I'm incorrigible. So unable to yet identify the victim, the focus of the investigation started shifting toward following leads on suspects. Because of the widespread press on the case, information began to come in from Philadelphia. A Pennsylvania Railroad train conductor named Frank Swain had been interviewed by Philadelphia Police Chief Francis R. Kelly.
Swain had remembered that a Black woman acting suspiciously, and not simply just by being Black, on the train from Philadelphia just before the torso was discovered. He had seen the story in the papers and reported that she had two bundles with her, one very similar to what was described in the press as containing the torso. She also had paid for a return trip to Philadelphia, but then paid extra to get off in Eddington instead, which was unusual.
Oh, I didn't realize she paid extra.
Yeah, I didn't
yeah.
either.
Yeah, she would have had to buy the ticket from the conductor to do that. Yeah.
So what the hell?
Because they
check
your ticket on the train. So if she wanted to get off and then back on again, she would have bought it from
you. That is really...
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. It is really weird. Huh.
Weird plan, lady.
I'm telling you. What's up, Hannah? So he said she had opened a window in the train car to let in the cold winter air. Also unusual, and she had seemed very nervous, so he had spoken with her. She claimed to be nervous because she was returning from the hospital. She said she had gone there because she had slipped on some ice and was returning and was still in pain. And he had offered to help carry her packages. Oh man, that would have been bad. At the Eddington stop, but she rather sharply told him not to touch them. Maybe she should have yelled, "What's in the box?" No, and then spun around like Brad Pitt.
So the investigation continued in Philadelphia under the direction of Police Chief Kelly. His two special officers, Frank Geyer, who is known for having investigated the H.H. Holmes case, by the way.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So big time investigator. And James Tate and two detectives, Peter Miller and Thomas Crawford. This was apparently the entirety of the Philadelphia investigative force for a population of close to 100,000.
Yeah.
What? Whoa. Yikes. Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, yep. you know, the police force is relatively new in this at this time.
Oh, so, right. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. Got to catch them slaves.
People. Yeah. People were used to policing themselves generally. Mm-hmm. And so there was sort of community watches or whatever.
Yeah, sounds scary.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They had some difficulty focusing on the case because on the night of February 19th, 1887, a suspended officer from the department decided to go postal on the place before going postal was a thing.
Really?
Wow. He had been suspended for drunkenness, neglect of duty, and assault. Okay.
Wow.
So, of course, his logical choice was to get drunk, go to the police station, and shoot it up with a revolver in each hand.
Because why not? Because
valid
why not?
Life choice. He didn't succeed in killing anyone, which he had stated he planned to do. This guy's a loser, man.
Wow.
Fail. But he did succeed in rattling the department as well as the public, distracting them from the torso case.
As widespread press continued involving both cases, a woman named Jenny Cannon came forward to suggest that the victim was likely her missing brother, Wakefield Gaines. She said he had gone missing right before the torso was found and was in the habit of keeping in touch with her on a daily basis. The fact that he had not come by her house since then and had not told her of any plans to leave town, which he would have done, she was certain that he was the victim.
Jenny told police that Hannah Mary Tabbs had threatened to kill Wake before. She had seen Tabbs attack her brother and beat him out of jealousy when he spoke with another girl on the street. She said that Tabbs had claimed she would get even with him.
Whoa.
Jenny also explained that she, Tabbs, and Wakefield Gaines used to work together as servants in the same household. She said that Tabbs' niece, Annie Richardson, worked with them as well, and that Tabbs became very angry one time when Wakefield was joking with Annie. She said that Annie disappeared soon after that. Then Hannah Mary Tabb stopped working for the household 4 months later.
Oh, this Jenny had a lot of information.
Yeah, she's spilling the tea.
Yeah, she is. So the investigators decided to bring Tabbs in for questioning as Jenny's description of her matched the description of railway conductor had given of the suspicious woman on the train. Tabbs must have realized the implications of Jenny having been called in for questioning as she had chosen this time to take the train back to Eddington and report her niece missing.
While she was at the police station there, she also expressed curiosity about the torso case. She may have been fishing for information to see how the investigation was coming along and possibly get some details. Philadelphia investigators James Tate and Peter Miller were watching return trains in Philadelphia as she was coming back, and they arrested her as she arrived back at the train station there.
She insisted that they were making a mistake in arresting her, that she was not the person who did this. She burst into tears when they tried to question her at the police station. The only clear response to any questions that she would give or that she was acting strangely that night on the train because she was in pain from having slipped on the ice, and that she did know Wakefield Gaines, but only because she and her niece used to work with him.
I was thinking she burst into tears, but it sounded like it didn't work.
Yeah.
And I also was thinking that after watching Kyle Rittenhouse on the stand for Christmas, I would like white tears. So that I can get out of things. So she would not give a straight answer to any other questions they asked and contradicted herself on the vague answers that she did give. They kept her in a holding cell overnight. In the morning, Chief Kelly spoke with her to see if he could get any additional information from her. She declined to speak with him other than to say that she had a headache. Oh, she's trying to do all the things that white ladies do when they don't want to do something.
Work.
But it doesn't feel good.
What a headache. So
sad. But he did get her breakfast and he told her he'd return later.
Detective Crawford tried again in a few hours, but she again wouldn't answer any questions. She would instead interrupt him and say, "Why don't you get Wilson?" She wouldn't explain any further to Crawford and insisted on speaking with Chief Kelly instead. When Kelly arrived, she gave a confession.
Chief Kelly and the others listened to her confession and noted that she seemed very calm and unbothered while speaking. According to them, she described the dismemberment like she was describing slaughtering a chicken, and appeared to have no emotions about the murder or the disposal of the body.
She also had a black eye that she still insisted was from falling on the ice. Mm-hmm. From this, they decided that she must have had more to do with the murder than she was admitting to, and that she wasn't just a bystander.
Based on Tab's confession, they tracked down and arrested George Wilson. The police beat him while in custody to get him to confess, as you do, you know.
Yeah,
their methods were not great. They're still not great. so he did, in fact, give a confession, but his account differed from Tab's after the point when he hit Wakefield with the chair. And I wouldn't be surprised to hear that they fed him the details. Yeah. So he might have been just saying whatever
they wanted to hear.
Because it's that kind of interrogation tactic.
Uh-huh.
You're just going to say whatever you have to say in order to get it to stop. So you're not necessarily going to get the truth that way.
Yep. Wilson said that after hitting Wake, he ran from the house. When he came back later, the body had already been dismembered, and Tabs handed him a package to throw in the river. He said she told him she would kill him if he opened it.
Whoa. Now, he said he took the package, which he later learned contained the head and limbs. He threw it over the Callahill Bridge and didn't come home until 11 p.m. He said he didn't see Tabs again until after she was arrested.
Investigators searched the river in the area where Wilson had said he'd thrown the package, dredging for 100 square yards, but never found anything. No one ever found the additional body parts. And again, I got the Nightmare Before Christmas in my head. You know that scene when Jack goes off and the mayor says, "Did anyone think to dredge the lake?" Well, they did.
Yeah,
but
they didn't
find anything. Not even Jack.
One source I found said they did find other body parts, but they were...
Yeah, not his, though.
Not his,
Random body parts.
They were just random body parts.
Probably they were like medical waste that they were, you know. Or other people who, you know,
good
probably
grief.
Black folks who had been murdered and nobody...
Other black folks, and they were like,
Yeah, whatever.
Nick.
Yep.
From DNA testing to the Dixie Mafia, Crime Capsule brings you new stories of true crime in American history. I'm your host, Benjamin Morris. Join us for exclusive interviews with authors from Arcadia Publishing, writing the hottest books on the most chilling stories of our country's past. You can find us wherever you get your favorite podcasts or on evergreenpodcasts.com. Crime Capsule, history so interesting, it's criminal.
So now we're going to get into the trial. What's the what, Beth?
At the coroner's inquest to determine cause of death, Tabs was brought in. They uncovered the torso and she identified it as that of Wakefield Gaines. She also identified the shawl strap and calico cloth as those with which the torso was wrapped. A coroner's hearing followed with Tabs and Wilson in attendance.
The investigators and a few other witnesses testified at this hearing. The coroner's jury decided on March 2nd, 1887, that the torso was indeed that of Wakefield Gaines, and the cause of death was blows dealt by Wilson. They declared Tabs to be an accessory to the crime.
The actual trial began on May 31st, 1887. District Attorney George S. Graham said that he would try George Wilson first and begin jury selection right then. Courts worked pretty quickly back then.
Yeah.
Tabs was called to the stand to repeat her confession, which she did. She gave the same account as previously described.
Other witnesses, neighbors, and other locals were called who described seeing blood at the scene, as well as seeing the carpet having been removed and washing tubs sitting where they weren't normally. Another witness said that she had been paid to take away a bundle of clothing by Mary Tabs, and Tabs had told her to pawn it for her.
When police tracked down and collected the bundle, they found an item of clothing with blood on it and blood on the paper wrapping the bundle. The paper was also similar to the paper found on the torso.
Other witnesses were called over the next 4 days. days to discuss Wilson's past behavior and work habits, and to testify as to whether or not noises had been heard around the time of the murder in order to help identify what had actually happened.
Witnesses were also called to try to determine whether or not Wakefield had still been alive when he was dismembered, as that would speak to the brutality of the murder and whether it should be first or second degree murder. The trial ended after 5 days.
George H. Wilson was found guilty of first degree murder, though his counsel sought and was granted an additional hearing, after which the judge accepted a plea of second degree murder. So that means he was dismembered while alive?
No, it means he was not.
Okay.
Yeah. So originally the judge accepted that Wakefield was alive when he had been dismembered. But in the additional hearing, there was additional scientific evidence given. And so that at that point, the judge accepted that he was not.
Alive.
Yeah. Okay. So he was
not alive.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Man, what would I do without you two? So the trial was the trial was fast, and it was likely easy to convict him because he was mixed race.
Right.
And therefore, or a societal threat as far as the white majority was concerned.
Hannah Mary Tabbs was then tried and quickly found to be an accessory to murder, even though much of the evidence seemed to point toward her having a lot more control over the situation than she had admitted to. She was sentenced to 2 years in prison.
Wow.
Yep.
Wilson was young, impressionable, and was described by others as lacking intelligence. So the true driver of the murder, dismemberment, and disposal of body parts in separate locations was very likely Tabbs.
So now we're going to get into where are they now? Well, this all happened a long time ago, though not a galaxy far away. It really isn't that long ago. They're all dead. Everybody is dead. George Wilson was sentenced to 12 years in Eastern Penitentiary, and Tabbs was sentenced to only 2.
Annie Richardson, Tabbs' niece slash daughter, turned out to not be missing after all.
Huh?
Well,
yeah. Surprise twist. Yeah. So it turned out that she had simply run away to get away from Tabbs and her violent outbursts.
Oh,
so she was avoiding her.
Yeah. Right. Of course. Mm-hmm.
In one account, Annie was reported to have said that she had seen Tabbs attempt to poison Wake Gaines by putting arsenic in his beer about a week before the murder. After he had recovered, his boarding housekeeper asked him what had happened. And he said, quote, "Oh, it was a woman. She did it," unquote. Whoa.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow.
Prophetic words, if there ever were any.
Yeah.
I'm without words. To be honest with you now. So now we're going to get into what made Tabbs snap. What are your thoughts, Minnie, Beth? Would any of you like to go first?
I'm going to defer to Beth because she is so good at this kind of thing.
Let's discuss then.
Well,
yes.
Well, thank you, bud. So I don't buy Tabbs' story that Wake Gaines just suddenly got up and hit George Wilson for what reason? You know,
what was the reason?
Yeah.
What's in the box?
So I was reading about this story, and I read that Tabbs was waiting for John to die because he was older than her.
Ah.
And then she planned on marrying Gaines. I don't know that Gaines had the same plan.
Yeah.
And I think Tabbs killed Gaines or enlisted Wilson to help her kill Gaines because she was pissed that he had become engaged to another woman.
Uh-huh.
And in the book, Hannah Mary Tabbs and the Disembodied Torso, the climate that Tabbs grew up in was described as extremely violent, especially for Black women.
Yeah.
So it's no wonder that she resorted to violence. You know, violence begets violence.
Amen.
I don't know why Wilson was involved. It sounds like he was vulnerable.
Yeah.
Like Minnie said, he lived in that home.
Yeah.
And
he was younger than her.
He was younger. He was only 18.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so he was vulnerable in that way. But also they said he had low intelligence. So poor guy. I mean, he probably helped in this, but, you know, I feel kind of bad for him.
Yeah.
And also because he was passing for white, or people thought he was, that freaked them the fuck out.
Isn't that funny?
So my gosh. I think they were harsher on him than they would have been otherwise.
Yeah.
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 So I thought that was a really interesting part of the story, how much white people were freaked out at the idea of black people passing for white.
Like it's just so funny, their reactions. Like,
there's aliens in our midst.
Oh, my God. This whole time, you know.
What was that TV show, V? Remember, they were passing for humans.
They were
all aliens.
Yeah. I remember Third Rock from the Sun.
V. Right. But, there was also Battlestar Galactica, the most recent one, with the Cylons who are passing for humans. Yeah.
Yeah. I think on the face of it, I've said this before, race is so stupid.
it is really stupid.
It's ridiculous.
It is.
And so, like, if you are a person who has, your community has been infiltrated, wouldn't you, like, wonder, like, well, what's wrong with us that we need, people need to hide amongst us?
Instead of saying, like, what is wrong with our society, they're like, we have to stop them.
We have to stop them, right. And I gotta say this, too. If the aliens are out there, they are not coming down here fucking with us. We're terrible. Why would they even want to? Why would they even want to pass as us? We suck. Human beings suck.
Yep. Yeah, that whole thing about passing, and why do they get so scared? Are they worried about limited resources and having to share with more people?
I think that's one reason.
But as far as, you know, what made her snap in that moment, I don't know. Her history of violence, I think she would have lashed out eventually at somebody.
And it
just kind of happened to be, unfortunately, this guy in that moment.
Yeah.
And I think Wilson just happened to be present.
Yeah.
And then she tried to pin it on him. You know,
right.
She tried to get him to do things that would make him look guilty. And ultimately it worked. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you see her survival skills kick in at almost every turn, right? Yep. I don't know how much she loved Gaines, or if it was also an opportunity for upward mobility to be with him or be married to him, but I think
she was infatuated with him. That's what the idea I got reading the book, that she was just like totally infatuated with him.
Ah, but then when she gets into trouble, she starts crying and feigning headaches and putting somebody else in the line of fire instead of herself as a means to survive. And I think that's probably something she learned very early. The other thing is the violent thing. I mean, she beat people up in front of other people. That's not something you're supposed to do. If you're going to kick somebody's ass, do it in private.
Yeah.
But she did it in public, and she came after him with a razor blade. Whoa!
So something else I read was that because she was so violent that nobody questioned her about anything she did. So she was having this affair with Wakefield Gaines, and pretty much everybody knew about it, but nobody confronted her on it. They're like, I'm just going to let her do that.
Not my business.
Minding your business
is free. So that's what I'm going to do.
Even her husband probably knew about it, is what I read. So, nobody wanted to cross her.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. She's a scary person.
She does sound like somebody you don't want to get on her bad side.
Right.
Also, City of Brotherly Love, where is the evidence of this? it sounds like it's a mess over there in Philadelphia. Yeah. It has been since the beginning. Also, this story, it has the best of all the worlds. Romance, sex, history, true crime. And per Dr. Callie Gross, this story has the elements of race, confinement, poverty, and law enforcement. And those are all still ongoing issues to this day.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I could not agree with her more. Which is why I give this story 5 stars.
Yeah. This was a great story.
I wanted to add so much more to it because it is such a complex story.
Yeah.
And it kept making me stop and think so many different times.
Yeah. Yeah,
I think
absolutely.
I'm gonna get the book that she wrote.
It sounds really interesting. Yeah. I've been listening to a lot of interviews with her, and I just can't get enough.
She's a fascinating woman.
She is. And I just want to urge people listening, this story has everything, and our sources are linked in the show notes, so you can also find out more about all the things related to this case. So now we're going to get into how not to get murdered. So if you love true crime and you don't want to die, here's a tip for you. Yay! We did it!
This segment is not intended to be victim blaming. We thought of this segment because I read somewhere that a lot of people listen to true crime because they want to know what they can do to be safer. This is not meant to blame the victims. It's just learning from other people's experiences.
However,
yeah, this week we have no tips.
Wait, except for that, what was that thing we were talking about? The soup can in a sock?
Oh, yeah.
We were just joking. Mostly just joking. Oh. Well, yeah.
So Minnie has been ordering food. She doesn't want to go to the grocery stores, you know, like a lot of us. She has her groceries delivered, and sometimes there's stuff in her groceries that she didn't order. So she has like, I don't know, 4 cans of white beans or something like that.
Why they gotta be white? I didn't order any white beans.
And they just appeared, huh?
Yeah. They just included them in the order, and I didn't get charged for them, but they're there.
So she was talking about what to do with them. She was talking about donating them to the food bank or whatever. And so we were joking about using them as
weapons?
To protect ourselves.
Weapons,
throwing them at so people, just, putting them in a sock.
And to, you know, to whirl around.
And hit somebody in the head.
Can nunchuck.
Wow.
But it was just a joke.
Don't do that.
You know.
Got it.
The soup can could be taken out of your hand and used against you, so don't.
Yes, of course.
We can't forget that.
So anyway, we'd like to invite Fruities, you guys listening, to send us your tips on how not to be murdered. We get a lot of really good tips from you guys, so keep them coming. Yeah.
All right. Well, now it's shout out time, where we shout out any content by or about any othered or marginalized folks or any true crime goodies.
So I wanted to shout out the movie The Harder They Fall on Netflix.
Fuck yes.
Yeah.
Five times.
Yeah. Wow. So it's a Western, which you used to not give a fuck about.
But that was until I realized 25% of the cowboys in this country, probably more, were black.
Mm-hmm.
And cowboy is a racist term.
Yeah.
Yes.
So it's a Western featuring an almost all black cast. It's like, I don't know, 99% black.
Yep.
And it's so entertaining. I really loved it. So really well done. Yeah.
Really well done. You got to watch it with the whole family. It is amazing. The Easter eggs too. Like that train they walk by is called Chadwick Boseman train.
I didn't notice that.
Yeah, there's like little beautiful Easter eggs.
I'm going to have to watch it again. The guy who
directed the movie is Seal's younger brother. You know Seal, the dude who sings?
Yeah, of course
One of the storefronts in the black town is called Carter and Carter, like Beyonce and Jay-Z. Carter and Carter. I mean, come on. I'm going to now watch it a sixth time. Thanks, Beth.
Okay. All right. You're welcome. What do you got, Minnie?
Well, now I've got a Seal song running through my head.
We're never going to survive unless we get a little crazy.
Yes.
Yeah. I used to love him. Still do. Anyway, I'd like to shout out Dr. Kelly Nicole Gross, who we've been talking about. The majority of the content for this story this week was drawn from her book, Hannah Mary Tabbs and the Disembodied Torso. Mm. She did extensive research on the case and is a very interesting woman herself.
Yeah.
She's a black woman, and she is a professor at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. So if you're in Atlanta, Georgia, go take a class from her. Sounds like awesome. So here's I'm just going to read off a couple of bios on her. The first is from the Emory University website, and then the second one is from her own website. So from Emory University, Kelly Nicole Gross earned her BA from Cornell University in African Studies and her PhD in History from the University of Pennsylvania. She is the National Endowment for the Humanities Professor of African American Studies and also the Publications Director for the Association of Black Women Historians from 2019 to 2021, and a distinguished lecturer for the Organization of American Historians, end quote.
Nice.
And then the second bio from her own website, quote, her primary historical research explores Black women's experience in the U.S. criminal justice system, and her expertise and opinion pieces have been featured in press outlets such as Vanity Fair, Time, The Root, BBC News, Ebony, HuffPro, Warscapes, The Washington Post, and Jet.
Wow. Ooh, Jet. Okay, yeah. Jet Magazine. That's mm-hmm. a throwback.
Yeah. So she has appeared on venues such as ABC, C-SPAN, NBC, and NPR. Her award-winning books include Colored Amazons, Crime, Violence, and Black Women in the City of Brotherly Love, 1880 to 1910, winner of the 2006 Letitia Woods Brown Memorial Book Prize, and Hannah Mary Tabbs and the Disembodied Torso, A Tale of Race, Sex, and Violence in America, winner of the 2017 Hurst and Wright Legacy Award for Nonfiction. Her latest book, co-authored with Diana Ramey Berry, is A Black Woman's History of the United States, and that was published by Beacon Press in 2020. End quote.
Oh,
and
right.
She also has her own website. The link will be in the usual places.
Yeah.
In the show
yes.
notes. Yep.
Yes.
And then another suggestion that I had, this is more of a fun thing. I like a lot of things that just kind of get me out of the darkness, because I am a very empathetic. I have a tendency to get a little just too feeling in my feelings. For yes. a lot of this stuff. So I like to have other fun things that kind of help me unwind. And anyone who knows me knows that I am almost constantly watching RuPaul's Drag Race, because I just love drag queens, and they just yes. have this thing about them that just, it's just uplifting. And yeah. So I'm just fascinated by drag queens. So I wanted to shout out Todrick Hall. I don't know if he's been shouted out on Fruit Loops yet. Do you recall
him? I don't think
ever?
So.
I don't okay. think so.
Yeah. So, all right. Okay. So, oh, yeah, I'm terrible at doing that. Still working on it.
Keep practicing.
Yep. So he is a Black American singer, songwriter, choreographer, and YouTuber.
Oh.
I know him mostly from RuPaul's Drag Race. He does the help with the choreo and help with the coaching singing.
Oh, okay.
And,
okay.
And I know him from his YouTube videos. You may have heard some of those. Though he was apparently also on the 9th season of American Idol, which I know
oh, wow.
you like.
What?
And yeah. So apparently I need to find the 9th season of American Idol, and he made it to the semifinals.
Get out of here.
Yeah. I haven't seen it because I never watched American Idol, but as I was looking up, I learned that about him, and I absolutely love him.
Yes. I am looking at photos yep. on Instagram. I love him too.
Oh, he's a, yeah.
Oh my God.
Yep.
Woo.
Although, you know, he does not like the ladies. I mean, not in that way. He likes the ladies. But
yes.
Not, yes.
Loves
yes.
the girls, and the girls he's, love him back. Yes.
Yep.
When I say girls, I mean everybody.
Girl, why not that girl just say girl?
Oh, okay. So just
so check
to
him
recap.
Out.
Okay.
Yeah. All right.
So that's The Harder They Fall. If you don't watch it, I'll kill you. It's on Netflix. I'm just kidding. And then Dr. Callie Nicole Gross, all over all the internets. And she has a book. Oh, lots of books. She's a doctor. And then also Todrick Hall, who is on RuPaul's Drag Race. He's a mm-hmm. choreographer and singing coach and a YouTube sensation.
Mm-hmm.
So check all those things out. Okay. Only because we talked about Passing a lot in this episode.
Mm-hmm.
There's a show called Passing, or a movie called Passing, on Netflix. It's only like an hour and 40 minutes. It's not long at all. But it is about a 1920s mm-hmm. New York City Black woman who finds herself, her world upended when her life becomes intertwined with a former childhood friend who is passing as white. They're both light-skinned. And so it is just amazing. And it's a really interesting window into the life of passing Black
yeah.
women in the 20s. And then there is a podcast called Harsh Reality, the story of Miriam Rivera. And Miriam Rivera is a trans woman who in the 90s, early 2000s, when reality TV took off, they were like, what's going to be the next thing that's going to get people watching? So they did this dating show where they had a trans woman cast as the love interest for these eligible bachelors, and she was going to choose from one of them. But the secret wouldn't be revealed until the end that she was a trans woman. And
oh, wow.
the men, I believe, they freaked out. I think that I'm not through all the way through it, but there's a tragic end to this.
Yeah.
We can only imagine what yeah. that might be. So
right.
Just interesting about Passing. So it's Passing on Netflix, Harsh Reality, wherever you get your podcast. And I think that's it for today. Where can the people find us, Beth?
Our website is fruitloopspod.com. Our Facebook page is Fruit Loops Pod, and our discussion group is Fruit Loops Pod Discussion on Facebook. We are also on Twitter and Instagram at Fruit Loops Pod, and links to our sources will be in our footnotes. If you want to support the show, you can send us a donation on the Cash App. Just Google Fruit Loops Pod Cash App, or you can become a monthly patron through Podbean. This will help us pay for things like our website and pod hosting. There's no minimum and no commitment. Even a dollar would help. And as always, we have merch for sale on our website. Happy holidays. We hope your holidays, whatever they happen to be, are lit. And we wish the best for all of our fruities out there.
Yes, we do. Now, this is a weekly podcast and new episodes drop every Thursday. So until next time, look alive, y'all. It's crazy out there.
This is Gary Chachot welcoming you to check out the French History Podcast. Our main show covers the history of France from the first humans until present. If you liked Mike Duncan's The History of Rome and wanted a similar program covering the land of beauty, culture, and love, we are exactly that. We also host world-renowned scholars who have delivered guest episodes on their specialties, including 18th century pirates, revolutionary booksellers in 20th century Paris, the special friendship between the Marquis de Lafayette and Thomas Jefferson, and numerous others. Learn what you love and listen to the French History Podcast today.
I'm an American vigilante. I have a question for you. What would you do if someone you cared about was abducted, taken from you? Would you call me? Would you care about how I got them back? Download American Vigilante now.